I'm Tommy McNeil. An Iranian-backed militia is vowing revenge after U.S. military airstrikes on fighters in Iraq and Syria. AP Sagar Magani reports from the Pentagon.
Pentagon Chief Mark Esper says the military took action yesterday in retaliation for a rocket attack that killed an American contractor in Iraq.
By launching F-15 Strike Eagles against five targets associated with Kitab Hezbollah.
What Esper calls an Iranian-sponsored militia group. A militia spokesman, though, says it was not behind the attack in Iraq and elsewhere, saying Washington is looking for a pretext to attack. He's calling the airstrikes a crime and massacre and insists the group will get revenge for evil American aggression. Sagar Magani at the Pentagon.
The family of the man accused of attacking a Hanukkah celebration in New York speaks out. AP's Rita Foley.
Grafton Thomas's family says he's mentally ill and has a long history of hospitalizations. He's accused of storming into a rabbi's home in Muncie, north of New York City, and stabbing five people as they celebrated Hanukkah. Thomas's family says he's never been convicted of a crime, is not a member of any hate group, and has no known history of anti-Semitism. In a statement issued by an attorney, the family expressed its concern and prayers for the injured. Meanwhile, Thomas remains in jail. He's pleaded not guilty to five counts of attempted murder. I'm Rita Foley.
The Al-Shabaab militant group has claimed responsibility for carrying out Saturday's truck bomb attack in Mogadishu, which killed at least 90 people, wounded about 125 others. Al-Shabaab's official spokesman said the group's target was a Turkish convoy and security forces. Turkey has been training the Somali army at a modern training facility in Mogadishu, inaugurated in September 2017, and has also implemented development projects in Somalia. This is VOA News. Hong Kong protests show no sign of slowing as the city heads into 2020. We get more from Reuters' Libby Hogan.
The protesters say they won't end until all five demands have been met. These include an independent inquiry into the police handling of the protests and amnesty for arrested protesters. Since June, police have arrested 6,060 people in total. The police say they've been restrained with an appropriate use of force. They've defended their conduct, including firing water cannons and tear gas, in response to what they call escalating illegal and violent acts of protesters.
That's Reuters' Libby Hogan reporting. The Taliban says it does not intend to stop fighting in Afghanistan, rejecting as false and baseless reports the insurgent group is ready to declare a temporary ceasefire in a bid to seal a peace deal with the United States. The announcement comes one day when Taliban insurgents killed at least 14 Afghan security forces in the latest of a series of deadly attacks and assaults over the past week alone. The White House says that Russian President Vladimir Putin has called President Trump to thank him for information that helped foil a potential terrorist attack in Russia. Russian media cited the Federal Security Service as saying two Russians were detained because of the U.S. tip. A Sudanese court on Monday sentenced 27 members of the country's security forces to death by hanging for torturing and killing a detained protester. The verdict, which can be appealed, was the first connected to the killing of more than 200 pro-democracy protesters since the anti-government demonstrations began last December. Neil Innes, a frequent collaborator with British comedy team Monty Python, has died. AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
Neil Innes wasn't one of the principal members of Monty Python, but he popped up so often and in such memorable roles, he was sometimes called the Seventh Python, here playing the leader of Sir Robin's minstrels in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Later, he partnered with Eric Idle to create the Beatles parody group, The Ruddles. A statement from his family says Innes died of natural causes Sunday night, quickly and without warning. Neil Innes was 75. To be an idiot. I'm Ben Thomas.
Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to this holiday edition of Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 1st, New Year's Day 2020. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawians await a court decision about the May 21st, 2019 presidential election challenge.
I want all worlds to understand this, that the fight that we've been fighting is not even connected to the court case. So even if the court makes any decision, whatever way it goes, our struggle continues.
Timothy Untambo is chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. South Sudan President Salva Kiir and former rebel leader Riek Machar agreed last week to form a long-awaited unity government despite unresolved issues. Activists criticized Nigeria's controversial social media bill, and Uganda's Bobby Wine explains why he is challenging President Museveni in 2021.
He believes that the way to deal with our generation is to deal with the young man that represents it, that's Bobby Wine, blocking my musical shows, blocking me from any public interaction, trying to make it hard for me to speak to the people out there.
We look at Mozambique in 2019, from cyclones to insurgency to a peace deal, Pope's visit, and contested election. And the climate crisis is causing hunger for millions of Africans. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawians are expecting sometime this month, January 2020, a ruling from the country's constitutional court about the controversial May 21st, 2019 presidential election. The Malawi Electoral Commission declared President Peter Mutharika the winner, but two opposition political parties, the Malawi Congress Party and the United Transformation Movement Party, challenged the results in court on grounds that the election was fraudulent. Civil society organizations operating under the umbrella of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition have held protests demanding the resignation of Elections Commission Chair Jean Ansa. Timothy Untambo is the chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. He says the group will respect whatever decision the court renders. However, he says the citizens' movement aimed at building a new Malawi where leaders are held accountable will continue.
I want all worlds to understand this, that the fight that we've been fighting is not even connected to the court case. So even if the court makes any decision, whatever way it goes, our struggle continues. We would want Jane Ansa to be held accountable. We would want Mate to be held accountable. And as the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, we would want legal and policy reforms, even in the electoral sector, so that in future we are able to avoid the challenges that we have faced. So for us, we are looking at a bigger picture. We are looking at a country that we have to liberate from thinking corruption, a country that we have to liberate from impunity. This is what we're doing.
But Timothy, as you said, that you are not party to the court proceedings, but part of your demands is the resignation of the Elections Commission chair. What happens then should the court come out and say that Jean Ansa, the chair of the Malawi Election Commission, whatever she did in the May 21st election was fair? Would you still demand her resignation?
We do not think the court is sitting to actually vindicate anyone. Even, for instance, I would give you an example. The court might give a determination, but it will not be treating that TPEX was used. And for some of us, TPEX was not supposed to be used. There were some decisions and some inactions that this MEC leadership did. For instance, up to date, we do not know how they resolved the 147 complaints. We all know that in a democracy, the way public affairs are managed should be done in a transparent and accountable manner. And much as maybe the court might make a different determination, but we think she's incompetent. We think what she did is unethical. So we think we never sent her to manage an election. So on that basis, we are saying Jane Ansa betrayed us as citizens.
I'm sure you have met with this quasi-religious group, the Public Affairs Committee. Have you met with them?
Yes, well, I've met them. Actually, Mutharika met them, and he sent them to give us a feedback. And he sent them with very weird sort of demands from us. He said, one, Mutharika wants us to stop activism. So we said we are human rights activists, and that's our mandate. Two, they said Mutharika sent them that we should stop demonstrating. Then we said, what is Mutharika talking about? We have the right to protest and it's protected by law, and we do it in the ambit of the law. He also told them that we should stop strong language. He talked about violence. Then we said, who is violent? We have always advised people to be peaceful, and every time we have used peaceful means and legal means to exercise our rights. And it is Mutharika and his DPP who have been violent. Some of us have been attacked. There have been assassination attempts on our lives. There have been attacks on our family. So we said, go and tell Mutharika, it's him and his party. We should stop being violent because we are peaceful Malawians. Our call for Jane Anser to resign is not going to be compromised.
The PAC has been kind of active recently, talking to the particular politicians to embrace dialogue.
Yeah, dialogue is quite important. And we at HRDC have always engaged in dialogue. We have met the former president, and we have said we are ready to meet anybody when it comes to dialogue. But that dialogue should be done in the best interest of Malawians. We have also discovered that politicians, they are looking at the dialogue in a narrow sense, where they are linking the dialogue to the case in the court. For us, dialogue goes beyond the court case. We'll continue engaging on issues of national importance even after the court case. So it is wrong to link the dialogue to the court case.
Timothy, thank you very much again. It has been a pleasure speaking with you throughout the year. And let me say Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much. We also appreciate speaking to you.
Timothy Omtambo is the chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi. You're speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. As Uganda's presidential nominations draw closer, politician Robert Chakulayi, better known as the musician Bobby Wine, has vowed to rock the halls of power with a run for the top job. Wine describes President Yoweri Museveni's 33 years in power as a dictatorship. Museveni, meanwhile, has described Wine as an enemy of prosperity and in November called for more riot police to deal with his opponent. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Ugandan musician turned lawmaker Bobby Wine was once known as the ghetto president for his support base in city slums. But 2019 became the year Wine announced a bid to challenge President Yoweri Museveni for the actual top office. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Wine says he decided to run for president because Museveni has lost touch with young Ugandans.
He believes that the way to deal with our generation is to deal with the young man that represents it, that's Bobby Wine, blocking my musical shows, blocking me from any public interaction, trying to make it hard for me to speak to the people out there. In my opinion, he seems to be fighting with a ghost he cannot touch.
Wine and his supporters describe Museveni, who has been president since 1986, as a dictator. For his part, Museveni calls Wine an enemy of progress because he asks foreigners not to invest in Uganda until there is a change in leadership. The government has used police beatings and pepper spray, known as kamlali, to shut down Wine's concerts and break up protests by his supporters. Museveni recently said that authorities need more muscle.
We now need manpower for the riot police to deal with some of our customers here in town, because we want just to kamlali without killing anybody.
Museveni is also trying to connect with young people and slum dwellers, a constituency that critics say he has ignored. In October, he appointed Wine's fellow musician, Mark Bugembe, known as Butcherman, as his presidential advisor on ghetto affairs. Butcherman, who took over the unofficial title of ghetto president when Wine became a lawmaker, rejects critics who say Museveni is using him.
So the ghetto president has no party. The development has no color. It is for all Ugandans. Dawa, I stood up just to come to save Uganda. Yes, I'm just there to connect the government with the ghetto people.
Analysts say Bobby Wine's quick rise in politics is due to young people tiring of false promises. Tolit Charles Atia is from the Institute for Policy Reflection and Security Studies.
So this wave we are seeing is a strong statement from the young persons that men, there is a raw deal. there is a raw deal in this you're telling us, and I think we're going to confront it.
Uganda's Electoral Commission has scheduled presidential nominations for August 20 of this coming year, with Wine and Museveni expected to be their respective party's choice in the 2021 general election. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir and former rebel leader Riek Machar agreed last week to form a unity government by the February 2020 deadline, despite still unresolved challenges. After an hour-long meeting at the State House in Juba on December 18, 2019, Kiir and Machar said they would complete implementation of security arrangements by the end of the 100 days extension, but did not agree on the number of states and their boundaries. Wake Saima Wudu reports from Juba.
President Kiir and Machar emerged from their meeting to confirm to reporters they did not reach agreement on the contentious issue of states and boundaries. Machar spoke first before the cameras in Arabic.
We are not able to move ahead, but we said let us wait until the deputy vice president of South Africa comes, because he was the one working with our committees. We will come and listen to his report. Maybe he will come and help us with the issue of the number of states.
Speaking in Arabic alongside Machar and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, deputy president of the Sudanese Transitional Military Council, President Kiir said, despite reaching no deal on the number of states, he will form a unity government with Machar in February.
We and the guarantor have said after the 100 days, we have to form the government. And if there are other things not done, we will task that government, because that is a unity government. We will task it with the things that are not completed and implement them.
Kiir emphasized that no one should return the country to war. Machar says he and the president agreed to ensure that all security arrangements, including cantonment, training of joint security forces, and the redeployment of forces, is completed before the 100 days of the pre-transitional period expires.
We have reached an understanding that in a period of 1 or 2 weeks, we should be able to start training of the security forces in the training grounds, say in Gorom, in Upper Nile, or in Owinkibul, or in Mapel, and so on, so that we are able to meet the 100 days deadline, because we want, by the time we finish the 100 days, there is a ready joint security force.
The failure by the parties to resolve the issue of number of states, their boundaries, and all security arrangements has prompted the U.S. government to place sanctions on certain individuals it says has impeded the peace process. The parties missed two previous deadlines to form the unity government, one in May and an extended deadline in November. Lack of trust between the two leaders has also been a factor in delaying formation of the unity government. Machar says he and Kiir agreed to expand access across the country to create a free environment for the effective implementation of the peace agreement.
We agreed to open for political space and freedoms for free movement, and so on, so that we as parties to the peace agreement, we can be in a position to start programs of disseminating the peace agreement to all the citizens.
The two leaders did not take questions from reporters at the end of their meeting. Machar is expected to return to Khartoum soon. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, January 1st, New Year's Day 2020. And we want to wish you, our dedicated listeners, a Happy New Year. The Nigerian Senate will this year, 2020, take up the proposed and controversial social media bill, which empowers the government to cut off internet access or block specific social media platforms such as WhatsApp, Facebook, and Twitter. Also known as the Protection from Internet Falsehood and Manipulation Bill, the act prohibits statements online deemed likely to be prejudicial to national security. Tens of thousands of Nigerians have signed an online petition to kill the bill. Femi Falana is a Nigerian Nigerian lawyer and human rights activist. He says the bill should die in parliament because it seeks to stifle free speech in Nigeria.
Nigerians are opposed to the bill, and the Senate has pushed further debates on the bill until next year, which for me is a way of recognizing the public mood, which is totally at variance with the bill.
Well, I think one of the things I see is that the bill prohibits statements on online that are deemed likely to be prejudicial to national security. Nigeria, as a sovereign country, don't you think it has the right to protect its national security?
There are sufficient laws to deal with national security. There are sufficient provisions of the criminal code, the penal code, and other laws to handle or to deal with threats to national security. So we do not need another bill that will provide the death penalty for those who may be alleged to threaten national security. The bill is totally against public interest, totally against even national security.
Let me also say that people have said a lot of nasty things on the social media. Maybe that could be one of the reasons too.
Right now, there are journalists and other members of the public that are on trial in not less than 10 states in the country for embarrassing government officials. In fact, one of the seven count charges against Mr. Omoyele Sowore has to do with the fact that he engaged in cyber stalking by embarrassing the president, and he's been charged under the Cyber Crimes Act. So you don't need another bill.
So you are saying the government can take people to court instead of a bill?
The government is already doing that. And I'm saying, I'm defending at least two of the cases where journalists have been charged with embarrassing one government official or the other. But the position of our law is that if you feel offended by any statement made by a journalist, you should go to court and sue for libel. But you can't use the machinery of the government, of the state, to embarrass your opponent by charging him or her with criminal offenses. And that is what the social media bill is all about. It's to shield public officers from criticism. No more. It's not about national security, which is already being taken care of by other laws in the country.
I understand there's been an online petition. What is the response from Nigerians?
Oh, Nigerians are totally opposed to the bill, and they are not going to allow it.
Femi Falana is a Nigerian lawyer and human rights activist. You're speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. 2019 was a tough year for the Southern African nation of Mozambique, with a violent, disputed election campaign, two devastating cyclones, a shadowy insurgency, an ongoing corruption scandal, as well as a visit by the Pope, in which he attempted to bring the nation together. As the coastal nation looks towards 2020 with a major multi-billion dollar Exxon Mobil natural gas deal hanging in the air, what lies ahead? And can this fractured nation be put together? Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
A violence-plagued, hotly contested election, a mysterious insurgency, and two deadly cyclones plagued Mozambique this year. But a historic ceasefire deal between the government and opposition and a visit from the Pope also spread messages of peace and healing. 2019 has been a whirlwind year for the Southern African nation, and analysts say the plot will only thicken in 2020.
And of course, all of this takes place against the backdrop of this expected massive incoming windfall, which will come in the form of revenues through the liquid natural gas deposits up in northern Mozambique. So, you know, this is a contestation not just for political power in Mozambique. This is also a contestation for the control over what could be a vast reserve of wealth for the country in the next 20 years. So really, the stakes are only going to get higher from here as well.
Mozambique's opposition claimed massive fraud in the October re-election of President Filipe Nyusi, which authorities deny. But the shadowy Islamist insurgency brewing in the rural north is also a main concern, says the Democratic Movement of Mozambique's Lutero Simango.
We are facing so many problems. We are facing the problem of militarization that is taking place in the north of Mozambique, I'm saying Cabo Delgado province. And at this moment that we are speaking here, we are having militarization in the central country in Mozambique, in the region of Sofia Manica.
Observers worry that the contested election may drive Mozambicans further apart. But the ruling Mozambique Liberation Front, Frelimo, won 73% of the votes this time, compared to under 52% in the last polls. Masterson says that shows Frelimo still has a great deal of support, though there are concerns about the numbers. Opposition politician Simango, who claims the poll was not free and fair, puts it a bit differently.
When the people's will is not respected, when the people's will is not valued, when the people's will is not taken into consideration, you are creating a situation of an illegitimate government.
Frelimo has held power since 1975, but was also one of the key brokers in the August peace deal that brought an end to decades of conflict. And that's a message that even the Pope touted when he visited the nation in September as part of a three-nation Africa tour. Peace, reconciliation, and hope. Three things that Mozambique badly needs to get through this trying time. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Tens of millions of people in southern and eastern Africa are facing emergency food insecurity, partly caused by climate change, with half of them children, according to the charity Save the Children. The area was hit by extreme cyclones, flooding and drought in 2019, and scientists warn the region is warming much faster than other parts of the world. As Henry Richwell reports, aid agencies called on world leaders who met last month at the climate conference in Madrid to commit to bigger cuts in greenhouse gases.
Cyclone Idai smashed into Mozambique in March this year, killing thousands of people and destroying entire settlements. The storm, one of the biggest on record, is estimated to have caused more than $2 billion worth of damage across the region. A month later, Mozambique was hit by another storm, Cyclone Kenneth, killing dozens more people.
Never before has this country been hit by two cyclones in the same season.
Save the Children says 2019 will be remembered as the year that the climate crisis devastated parts of eastern and southern Africa. The charity warns that climate change contributes to at least 33 million people in the region facing emergency levels of food insecurity, with more than 16 million of them children.
The link to climate change is actually the compounding effect of emergency after emergency after emergency. So the ability for people to recover from a shock, like a drought or a flood at the moment even, is getting less and less and less, and therefore their livelihoods are slowly but surely being eroded and literally washed away.
A 2015 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report shows temperatures rising in southern Africa at twice the global rate. Save the Children says leaders of industrialized nations must commit to bigger cuts in greenhouse gas emissions and greater support for those most affected by climate change.
If you are a child growing up in eastern and southern Africa, your chances of survival are currently being affected by actions that are taken by people in a completely different part of the world to which you have very little control or effect on.
29,000 delegates are meeting in Madrid for the COP25 climate conference. US President Donald Trump is not attending, having withdrawn from the landmark Paris Climate Agreement, which he says would unfairly penalize the United States economy. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That's it for this Wednesday, January 1st, New Year's Day edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, saying with every new year comes greater challenges and obstacles in life. I wish you courage, hope, and faith to overcome any hurdle that you may face this year. Happy New Year.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Hi, my name is Larry London.
Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs with time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here, and we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd, right here on Border Crossings.